Good evening, everyone. Nice to be back after a week away from the group here. We weren't actually away because we were just practicing a re doing a retreat somewhere else, but you were all continuing here, those of you who are here. So we, at our retreat, we were in a place we had never been before, and there were people who had never been at one of our retreats before. There was a lot of coming and going, people who came in just at midday for the Dharma talk. Occasionally someone would stay for Oriyoki. Someone came sometimes just at night for the sitting. And we all just sat and accommodated what arose. Someone in the group was having difficulty with the incense on the first day, was developing some kind of allergic reaction to the incense. I said, so we don't do incense. And we just put flower petals in a little bowl of water. Instead of offering incense, we offer flower petals. And we seamlessly did that. I never heard anything else about having incense or not having incense after that first day. And the people taking care of the altar just made sure that we had flower petals. It's farther south in Paris, and there were small spring flowers that were trees that were blooming, and plenty of offering to make. We could have even, had we not had flowers, we could have put stones and offered stones. We'd like to have on the altar the different elements. So we like to have, that's what the altar is intended to have. So we have fire, we have water, we have plants, smoke. We did without the smoke, and we offered something else. What was important was to make the offering. And we offered the retreat to those who came and went. We offered the retreat to ourselves, like we do for the sitting here. We make this available to whoever wants to come. We welcome anyone who wants to come and sit with us, to join us and share this time together and share words together, without judging, or creating hierarchies. If someone knows more than me, then I turn to them and ask. If I know more than someone, I offer my knowledge. I try to, instill in our Sangha the spirit that my teacher instilled in me, which was to meet people where they are. Which is really the role of the Bodhisattva, to the great Indian Buddhist Shantideva, who really elaborated on that. If people need a boat, then I'm a boat. If people need a bridge, I'm a bridge. And goes through all kinds of things. But we say that, and Suzuki Roshi said, if you need to help ladies, you become a lady. If you want to help boys, you become a boy. If you want to help a fisherman, you become a fisherman. And he cites there's a Chinese expression that said it's to be like a white bird in snow. Nothing special. just one with the environment, with the situation, what arises. And there was a great feeling, I think, in our retreat of doing that. The place where we were was not usually a spiritual, it was not a Zen center. This is very familiar for us in Wildflower. Rarely do we do retreats in an official Buddhist center. In Portugal, we often do them in Catholic places. So there is a spirituality already present, and a presence of a living activity around something other than commerce and ego-related activities or something. But this place was just buildings that had been purchased by a French couple who had left their lives of, high-level people in business or something, and gave all that up and sold their house in the Paris region and bought this place and renovated it. And they make money by renting it to vacation people in the high season, vacation season. But in the off season, they really want to develop it as a place of practice, whether it's yoga, whether it's the arts. They have a lot of artists who come for residencies, performing arts and things, choirs, theater groups, dance, different practices. And so we took our place there. We made it our own, and filled it with the presence of our practice, with our just daily activity together, which consists of a lot of just sitting, as we know in our retreats, but also working, eating, walking together, cleaning, and we expanded ourselves into the place with in that spirit. I received an email today from the owner who said that he thanked us for having left the place. I forget what his words were. Lisa, you received the mail too, I think. Do you remember what he said? Impeccably, as we had found it. Nothing was out of place from how we had found it, which is what we aspire to do, is leave no traces, accept the fact that we leave no traces, leave whatever is our practice has instilled in the place or something like that, even if it is having left no traces. So among all of the things that happened during a 6-day retreat, we just responded to whatever arose, we ate what the cook prepared. The people who worked in the kitchen prepared what the cook asked them to prepare. We stayed in the rooms we were assigned to. We used the cushions that were provided and the chairs and everything that was provided. And we came together and just sat. My family last night was asking me, my American family, who I meet every Sunday night on Zoom, and they were asking me, "Oh, so how was the retreat? And what do you do with the retreat?" And that's an interesting exercise to respond to, because for us it seems so obvious. And we say, "Well, we do a lot of meditation, and then at midday I give a talk." And "Oh, really? What do you talk about?" And "Can you give an example?" Well, it's really hard to give an example out of context. And I got out my notebook and I looked at my notes and I tried to give them some examples, but I had to put that all away and just find some way to meet them where they are, to be a white bird in snow. Different context, different people, different situation, different life experience. So, to be true to my practice, that's what I do. It's not always easy. But somehow I, try to make my best effort to do that. And I feel like as a Sangha, we do that as well. One of the talks was, I referred to the guy, the American Zen master who in his previous existence had been a drag queen and quite a famous one, a talented drag queen in San Francisco in the, at a time when it was really dangerous, like in the 50s. But San Francisco being a tolerant city, it was, he was kind of a star of the scene there. And quite outrageous existence. He had been a drug addict and came to Suzuki Roshi. His name is Isan Dorsey. Tommy Dorsey was his name before he became a Buddhist monk, but and he began practicing with Suzuki Roshi at the San Francisco Zen Center, and it changed his life. And he gave himself over to the practice, became a monk. And sometimes he liked to say, "Well, nothing is really different except that I don't wear high heels anymore." His life, he was still who he was, and he brought his same spirit to what he was doing. And the people in his former community, recognized that as well, that he had always had this presence and this way of being with people that was no different than in his Zen community. And I talked about him at the retreat because of his relationship to time. But one of the other anecdotes about him was that he, when he was a young practitioner, people around him were like ordaining to become monks or taking Jukai and things like that. And he thought about it and he went to Suzuki Roshi and he said, "I was going to come in here and ask to become your disciple and ordain and all of that. But I, you know, I, he said, but I was kind of looking at myself and I, I don't look like them. I don't, feel like I'm, I merit it or I'm worthy of it or something like that." And so he said to Suzuki, "But now I realize that it was just an ego trip on my part, thinking that I would ordain and have some special status or something." And so he said, "So instead of doing that, I'm just going to go on practicing and doing the best that I can." And Suzuki thought for a minute and he said, "Well, there's no difference between that and being my disciple." Which for Isan was a deep recognition and encouragement to just keep practicing, that he didn't need any special organization, he didn't need any special title, anything like that, that was the practice. He did, however, several years later, go on to receive Jukai and a Dharma name, and then I believe it was after Suzuki's death that he ordained as a monk by Richard Baker, who was Suzuki's American successor. But he did receive Jukai from Suzuki Roshi, though, and his Dharma name, which was Isan. Which means, I think it means one mountain. Which was a way of saying that his two lives came together as one. It wasn't even two lives. You know, it's like the Confucian saying of we have two lives. Second one starts when we realize we only have one. And he realized that. And as I talked about in the retreat, he set up, they set up a center that he was, it was actually a hospice because he came to become a monk and a teacher when the AIDS crisis exploded in San Francisco. And he set up his place of practice and a hospice for Zen patient for AIDS patients in the Castro district of San Francisco, which was the heart of the Zen community, of the gay community. And that center is still there, and still exists. So he extended his practice of, you know, a white bird in snow by the community in which he was living and practicing was devastated by this terrible disease. Some of them were his friends, some of them were not, but they were all his comrades, as all sentient beings are. And he's set up this hospice to treat them, be with them, meet them where they are, you know. He's an inspiring teacher, although he was not a saint and he was the first one to admit it. Some of his Zen, I think one of the stories is that the people in his previous existence, in the gay community and the drag transvestite community, always thought of him as a really kind, patient, attentive person. And some of his comrades in the Zen community would get annoyed with him because they said he was just this bitch. And yet he was all of that, and he didn't deny any of it. He made it one. So can we aspire to that in our practice? And in a very concrete way, can we move in the world with that same spirit and respond to our communities? Respond to the situations that arise, you know, in our individual lives, families, neighborhoods, in the world at large, in our Zen community, in our other activities, you know, whatever we do, our workplace. And also in our cities, countries, world. What is the world? The universe. And can we come to it with the spirit of being a white bird in snow, which requires great softness of heart and mind, you know? Not being fixed as to one position, one identity, one approach. We used to say that when I was a young journalist, they trained us and they said that we should be what in English we call a jack of all trades. It's someone who knows all the trades. We used to say a journalist knows something about everything and everything about something. So can we do that as well? So, you know, we may have something that we focus on. You know, we may have, you know, Isan Dorsey had his gay community who was devastated by AIDS, who he focused on. But that did not mean that he ignored the society ladies who came to sit or his Zen comrades who he went off on retreat with, or, you know, the bus driver or, you know, the former drug addicts that he knew before his, previously, or his family, or whatever. His focus, however, he devoted himself. This was his community, and that's what he focused on. In a sense, the world is our community. But it's overwhelming if we say, okay, I'm going to save the world. If you just make your best effort where you are, in what speaks to your heart, and help yourself through practice with your best effort, like Suzuki said to him when he said, you know, I can't be your disciple because I'm just, that's all I want. If you really do that, you can help others without anything. You don't need anything special. You can bring your presence to the world. You know, like I said, at that retreat center, we didn't do anything special. Of course, we paid for them. We paid for what we had said we would pay. We respected whatever rules they had, which weren't very many. We left nothing. And yet that's everything. We left everything there. We left our entire beings there. And at the lunch, at the brunch after, I sat with I talked with the owner, one of the owners, it's a couple, so the woman. And I discovered, I didn't know this before, that they are, you know, deeply Christian, this couple, Catholic. And so, you know, she was asking me, so what is this Zen thing? She came and sat with us for some Zen periods, Lisa gave her an introduction to how to sit and taught her to do Orioki. She had Orioki with us, and she came to a Dharma talk. So she was asking me questions about it because she wanted to understand. And I think really what she wanted to know what I said to see if that, what that said about her own experience. And she realized that her experience of what she had done with us and of us, she really could see how much that was not so different from her practice. She had been, when she was in Paris, she had been a aumônier. How do you say aumônier in English? There's a name for that. I can't remember. You know, it's someone who, like a chaplain, but a lay person who receives people who come and want to talk, right? And she had been in this center for young people in her town, in a Paris suburb. She had done that. And she was supposed to be, have as a reference, there was a priest who was assigned to that vicinity of the town or something, that parish and that center. But he didn't have any authority over her. She was in charge of this place. And so she would just listen. These kids, they were between the ages of, I think, 10 and 21 or something, could come, and she would just listen and guide them however she could. It was a time when the young people were supposed to do confirmation, which I think anyone who's been raised in a Christian context, you know what that means. You confirm, you know, it's a step in your process. And she said it was when the kids were about 13 or 14 years old. And so the process had started like in the beginning of the year, and they had retreats and things they had to do. And a girl came like after it had started and said to her, you know, I've thought about it and I really want to do it. I would really like to do the confirmation, but can I? Because they've already started the process. And the woman said, of course you can. You know, we'll catch up. You know, I'll tell you what they've done already and I'll help you. Of course you can. You can start wherever you are, you know. And then the priest heard about this and said, absolutely not. She can't just come whenever she wants. She has to do the whole thing, and no. And this woman, Anne, her name was, said, well, no. I'm the one in charge here, and I say she can start. And she said, can you understand that some people will come to the church through the front door? Others will come through a crack in a broken window up in the ceiling. And are you going to refuse the one who comes in the place that you don't think they should come in from following this path? You know, the priest had no choice. He had to accept because she was, it was her domain, you know. And as we conversed throughout the brunch then, you know, she was asking me, I heard this story, and I said, yeah, well, that's it. You know, that's what we do too. She was asking, so, oh, okay, so what about God and things like that, you know? And I told her the story about Mother Teresa, of Mother Teresa, who was interviewed, you've heard this story before, who was interviewed by a German journalist and asked her, when you pray to God, what do you say to him? And Mother Teresa said, nothing, I just listen. And then the journalist, who was surprised, said, okay, so what does he say to you when you listen? And Mother Teresa said, nothing, he just listens. And I told this story to Anne, and she said, well, that's exactly it. That's what, for her, that's what prayer is. And what she described of prayer was basically what we do when we sit. We just listen. We just pay attention to what's here. We just are present here to what is. And she went on to say how she has, that since they've moved here to this part of France and they live in the countryside and they're like 25 minutes away from three different places where there's churches where they could go. And they've tried them all and they're really disappointed with the priests who kind of give lectures and give nothing like what she, how she experiences her practice and her husband. And so she said, we've just decided to not go. And they live their practice. They do the best they can. Like what Suzuki said to Isan Dorsey, you know, you do the best you can and you that is your practice. She did not seem upset about this. She was very confident of it. About it, that this was the choice they needed to make. And that there was a priest who came three times a year to the church in their village because the boulangère and the baker in the village where we were knows this priest who lives somewhere a couple of hours away in Carpentras, which is, you know, kind of farther south, and brings this priest three times a year to their village. And so they go to that because they do like this person and his approach to what they consider, you know, their deep practice and a heart practice of listening to whatever is. That's what we do too, you know, that's what our practice is too. And then the response takes all kinds of forms, you know. It can involve you know, if it's a lady, you become a lady. If it's a boy, you become a boy. If someone needs a bridge, you become a bridge. Without any idea of discrimination, can we just respond? And I'm not telling you anything that you haven't already heard, but this came up during the retreat because we were talking about Isan Dorsey. And so I was thinking about him since then. So maybe I'll stop there and hear what anyone else has to say. What did you do last week? Or, what comes up for you when you hear this or something else, whatever you'd like to share, question. Wow.
Okay, so I was thinking about this when you were speaking, and this is something that has occurred to me sometimes. I'm reading the Power of Now from Eckhart Tolle, and it's a wonderful book to explain how our plans for the future or memories of the past, they're all, illusions. We can only live in the present. There is only the present. And but at the same time, I think that the way we live in the present depends on our past as well. We need to cultivate ourselves so that we can respond better in the future. So it's also dependent on time, I think. That was just my question.
Eckhart Tolle, that's a wonderful book. And what he talks about in that book is his experience. He's not telling anything like that he learned in a book or anything like that. That comes directly from his direct experience. So can you, you say we, of course, we behave in a certain way now because of where we come from or what our experiences were in the past. That's what we call karma. And so, yes, so we can we cultivate in this moment. This is why we try to pay attention to this moment, healthy, wholesome, non-harmful behavior, because if we do something harmful now, there will be a reaction in the next minute, that is probably harmful, and there are consequences from every reaction, every action. The thing about time, so in fact, we don't cultivate this moment projecting ahead. We cultivate now, for now. Because if we start projecting and getting ahead, then we're not truly present for what's here. The story that I told in the retreat about Issam Dorsey was that, I'm only bringing this up because you mentioned time, was that he was one of his students came and was telling him all about his problems in his life and saying, and was wondering what to do. He had several options of what to do, several choices he could make or paths that he could take or something. And so after he elaborated on this and Isan listened to it, and then the guy came to the end of it and he said to Isan, so what should I do? And Isan said, I don't know. I've just arrived. Meaning that we are always just arriving. We're always just arriving in this moment. There is no other moment, in fact. And if we start projecting and thinking I should do this or I should do that, or it doesn't mean we don't need to think and construct and organize our lives. That's not what it means. But we're living now. And that's the power of now. That's the power of Eckhart Tolle's his message. It's we are living now. It's always now. So if we start projecting, we're moving away from now. We're moving away from just what is. And then we fail to see what is the situation. what someone needs, what the situation calls for. And it's changing all the time, the situation. So we have to, that makes it even more important to not move from the moment because it's moving all the time. And if we, it's like, being in a boat and trying to hang on to a branch on the riverbank. If we're clinging to that branch and the boat is trying to go away, well, we're going to fall out of the boat probably. And lose sight of who we are and where we are and who's with us and what is. Yes, Shwan.
I was thinking, well, yes, openness to the moment is the ultimate the solution to all our problems, but we need also some structure from the past as well, because and to project into the future, because I've been a drunkard as well. When I was on that mind state, I could not operate very well. All my decisions were lousy. Now that I have better habits, I find that, I'm more at peace with the world. So I guess we need structure and openness at the same time.
Yep. That's a good example. If we choose to intoxicate our minds with whatever it is, then there's a consequence. If we choose not to do that, then there's another consequence. And we're free. Of course, addiction, it's something different if it's an addiction, then it's more complicated to just abandon the unwholesome intoxications. And it's not only alcohol or drugs, it can be food, it can be possessions, it can be telephone, on net social networks, all kinds of, stuff that we intoxicate ourselves with. It can be an attachment to self. I become really intoxicated with this, who I think I am and how wonderful I am and or how horrible I am and what a lousy person I am and I'm worthless or something. So yes, we do. We do need to. That's what our practice is about, is waking up to who we truly are, beyond all those identities and attributes that we've stuck on ourselves. And the more we intoxicate our, that's one of our precepts. When we take Jukai, is that we vow to refrain from intoxicating ourselves. Because it does, it compromises our ability to see things as they are. It's important too to realize that we all have that, whether we drink too much or drugs or food or whatever it is, we all have stuff. And when we recognize that, then we can have compassion for when we see that happening in others' lives. I went to the supermarket yesterday, and kind of the, not the fancy supermarket, kind of the lower supermarket, because it was close and the things I needed, it didn't really matter where I, and it's cheaper and it was just closer. And it was Sunday morning, very crowded. And I was overwhelmed. Yeah, of course, I was coming out of retreat, so I had a more direct experience of it. But I was really so. It was almost like, this poignant experience to see what people had in their carts, to see what people were buying. And this really unhealthy food, you know, and like sodas and all, you know, if it was vegetables, it was all canned or frozen, although it was possible to buy fresh vegetables in this supermarket. And part of it was what also what made it even more poignant was I know that they probably can't afford anything else. You know, it's cheaper, that stuff. And they probably, you know, and I came home and I was telling my sister-in-law who was here staying with the cats, I was telling her about this experience, you know, and she was like saying, oh, it's they have no education, you know, and she was taking this kind of like high-minded view. And I said, no, you know, it's not that. It's like, imagine this woman, you know, I'm just projecting possible scenarios and, you know, a single mother who has a full-time job and these children she has to feed. She comes home from work at night. It takes a lot of time to make, you know, a meal with, and not only a lot of time, but a lot of money to buy fresh vegetables and prepare it. And it's much easier to just open a can of ravioli and put it in a pan, you know, or just, you know, give the kids sugary breakfast cereal for breakfast, you know, and it's cheaper and it's easier given her the context of her life, probably. Not everybody was in that situation, but it is a supermarket where people who don't have a lot of money go, you know. And I was just really touched by that and thought about my own life and thought about, you know, when I have eaten junk food, what I consider junk food, totally unconscious, you know. Living in America, well, of course, when I was living in America, it was not at all like it is now, but it was still very present, you know. High school, there was McDonald's. One of the first McDonald's in the United States was across the street from my high school. Of course, we spent a lot of time there, you know. And, or even, you know, just it doesn't even have to be cheap, bad fast food. You know, the French traditional way of eating is you know, you have all these courses and you have all these different kinds of wine. And then you have an apéritif before that, and you have a digestif, and you even have this thing called a trou normand, which is supposed to like you just break in the meal. So it will burn a hole through all the stuff you've eaten so that you can eat more, you know? And you drink coffee after that because you're so like intoxicated by all the wine you've been drinking. I totally lived that life. You know, totally. And all of that, because I know that, you know, so João, when you talk about being intoxicated and whatever, so you can then have compassion for people when they do that, because you know what the consequences are. And you know what it feels like not to do that, and how much better you feel about yourself, and how much more present you are with others and to the situations. And, great compassion. That was a really moving experience in the supermarket yesterday for me.
Hello, can I ask something?
Yep. Hi,
Yeah.
Pedro.
Hi, thank you very much for your talk, Boshi. So just listening to your talk about, I thought this was a really beautiful image. You know, if somebody needs you to become a boat, become a boat. If and also the way you've sort of as I understood it, not sure if that was the meaning you're trying to convey, but as I understood it, that you were there in the retreat and whatever happened, you sort of adapted to it or sort of, you know, found your way through it or became one with what was happening in the space and the people, right? And I find all of that great, right? And that's something that I wish to practice in my own life as well. Yet you feel so much of it is about acceptance, right? And it makes me think, where is the role of resistance? And can we resist with the same compassion that we accept?
Well, I think it depends what is, you know, I'm not sure what you mean by resistance, but or do you have an example maybe or something?
I do. I suppose that, you know, for instance, I can be in a situation in Lisbon where I can see somebody of an African descent, for instance, being mistreated, in public services or by the authorities or whatever. I suppose I can offer my compassion to both the authorities because they're doing their role, the person who's being sort of abused or mistreated in some way, and sort of see how I can position myself indeed with compassion for both, right? And I think that would be the ideal position, right? I can decide to run away. I can pretend not to see it. I can stay silent, hoping for it to go away. I can hope that somebody else intervenes. And I can also go into the situation and sort of resist it in the sense that I think somebody's being mistreated. So I offer my resistance with the same compassion that I could offer my acceptance. So, and when I say resisting, it's possibly standing up for the person that is being mistreated in this, in my prototypical example, the person of African descent. So I guess the question that I'm contending with is, I mean, I've particularly since I joined the Sangha and started the retreats with you, I've had great benefits in sort of learning to accept things more in my personal life with the people that I love. I'm very grateful. I've had great benefits practicing the acceptance. But I'm also trying to figure out where is the right role for resistance.
Well, maybe maybe the way reason I didn't understand so much was because resistance is maybe not the word I would use in that situation. It could be accepting the need to speak up and intervene. Instead of thinking of it as resisting something, it's like opening to that possibility, opening to the possibility that you'll go away, that you won't say something or someone else, whatever it is. Can you open to that? And sometimes it's appropriate to intervene. Sometimes you might get your head beat too if you intervene. But maybe that's the risk you're willing to take because you're standing up for what seems to be the appropriate response in that situation. So I'm not sure, I wouldn't use the word resistance. I understand what you're saying, though, about do because that's what we often think is okay, well, do I have just to accept everything? Accept even not accepting sometimes, not accepting that this person is being discriminated against. Accept that, I used to have this really hard thing of I didn't want to say no to my teacher. And when I was receiving transmission and I was going to, be on my own and leave the very comfortable situation of being my teacher's student and really identified with that and being a member of the Sangha, it was devastating because I felt like I was saying no to her. I was saying no to not being with her, not doing what she wanted, or whatever it was. And it was really devastating. But I had to realize that by saying no to her, I was saying yes to myself. I was saying yes to this process. And I was ultimately saying yes to her because that's what the whole thing was about, so can we say yes to no?
That's helpful. Thank you. That's helpful.
I think this is something you already know, but sometimes it helps to hear it, but
I do know it, but sort of hear it in a sort of kind of straightforward, simple way. Not simple in the sense of not intellectually complex, but simple in the sense that you're not using a lot of words to say it, say yes to no. Kind of starts the conversation with my heart, not just my mind.
Exactly. That's exactly it. Yeah.
Yeah. So thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, can we say we look with our eyes, but we see with our heart, something like that? that also came up during our retreat. I don't remember in what context, but he said that. Okay, well, no one has anything to share. People are kind of looking away, so I think that means that they don't want to talk, and that's okay. I can say yes to that. Unless someone wants to share one last thing, then we can say the vows and finish.
Yeah, maybe I can share. I had my parents-in-law with us this week, and you know already a little bit about my father-in-law, especially. I really know that the way he behaves comes from a lot of suffering, and yet it's so difficult to see him with the heart, or you know, accept his stubborn and stupid behavior. Yeah. And then they left today, and I was just relieved that they go in on the same time. It made me feel sad that to feel like that I'm judging him, you know. But it's, yeah. It's just difficult to be around him.
Well, and you know, it, what's important in this situation is that you're aware of it and you acknowledge it and you do the best you can, given how it's difficult and you don't like it and you know, all the history with it and all of that, and yet you do the best you can. Unfortunately, you can feel it. You know, you didn't close your heart up or pretend that it wasn't happening, or, you know, indulge in all kinds of acting out behavior or refusing to have him come or something, even, which you would not do, I know, but.
Yeah, it's, it always makes me feel a lot of resistance against so much ignorance.
Yeah.
And feeling like anything that I say that I want him not to do, it's just like he does not consider any of that, you know? It just repeats his same behavior over and over and over again. Yeah, it's just all out of habit and of I mean, and I can see what you already said to me, that there is very little freedom in that kind of being, you know, that it's very narrow, and that also is a lot of suffering to not have any choices.
Can I add something quick to that from my own experience? Is that okay? So sometimes when I'm around somebody who I really struggle with for some reason, right? Really struggle for their beliefs, their ideas, who they are, how they treat others. I can feel bad thinking that it's all about my feeling for them. And I'm thinking about my sister-in-law in this case, but it's all about my feeling for them. But it's actually took me a while to understand this, that sometimes it's also, or next to it, how the person feels about themselves. You know, because if my heart is open to them, I'm not just going to feel my feeling for them. I'm also going to be feeling at some level how they are feeling about themselves. And that can stay for a while.
And in that context, you know, not that it's any consolation for you, but it's clear that he's suffering more than you are. And it's not like we're comparing degrees of suffering, but just the fact of your awareness and your sense of how much pain you see in his behavior, he doesn't see that. Although he's suffering, he's hurting, obviously. He wouldn't be behaving that way if he weren't.
And that goes onto the, you know, this morning when they left, my dog was sitting in the entry because he's all, when there are his luggage and he feels like something's going on, somebody's leaving, he doesn't want to miss. So he was sitting there quietly, calmly, and my father-in-law was stroking him, and then he touched him on the nose, doing some, and he said, "Yeah, he doesn't like that when I do that." And he continued doing it. He observes, he can see my dog doesn't like being touched that way, and he continues doing it. And that's just all the time. I didn't even say anything because I know that it wouldn't change anything. And he couldn't hear it, or I don't know.
If we take that to, like, you know, the macro situation of the world, we know the earth does not like what we're doing to it, and yet we keep doing it. So we are out of time. I'm sorry, Christine, to end it.
Thank you.
Time is up. So, Debbie, if we could do the vows and then